Okay. So we mentioned last time the for those who have the books, it's the Ma'amar Rishon, the first essay, and it's paragraph Lamed Aleph, which is 31. Let's just sum up what we were speaking about till then. The Chavir, the Rav, was in the midst of speaking to the Kuzari, the king of the Khazars, and he had told him that our claim, the basis of our religion is the experience which we, the Jewish people, have had with the various miracles that God has performed for us throughout the generations. Comes back the king of the Khazars to the Chavir, and he says, well, if that's the case, so really, your religion is really just for the Jewish nation. It's unlike other religions, which make a claim on universal truth. You're really just, everything is just for those people, that nation, who went through these experiences. And the Rav says, you're right. Yeah. As opposed to other religions that kind of try to proselytize and bring everyone into the fold, our religion is really just focused on the Jewish people, the Jewish nation. And in fact, we have this concept that although somebody can convert and take on the duties of being Jewish, there's something unique about those who were born biologically into the Jewish people. And that's, we spoke about it at length last time, the very unique position of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, not everybody agrees to, but this concept that somehow, the Jewish people biologically are different from the rest of the nations of the world. Again, we hasten to point out that although there have been those who have accused Rabbi Yehuda Halevi of being somewhat racist in this presentation, we said that there's a fundamental difference between, the Havdil, racism, and the point of view of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi assigns, as we're going to see actually in this next piece today, he assigns to all human beings the concept of human dignity. Right? It's just that the Jewish people have something that makes them, in a sense, superhuman, beyond the dignity which is afforded to regular human beings. As opposed to the systems of racism that, unfortunately, we've been familiar with throughout history, where the whole point of a racist ideology is only we are humans, everybody else is an animal. I mean, essentially, that's the point of view. The Nazis, for sure, we pointed out last time, the first thing the Nazis did when they took power in Germany is they outlawed Shechita because it was inhumane, right? Which, again, you look down years afterwards, I mean, it's... Ironic is not the word, right? Literally, the Nazis regarded animals with greater affection than they did Jews. They saw the Jews as being even on a lower madrega, lower level, than the animals. You know, the same is true the way the blacks were treated, in the American South. The white supremacists saw and continued to see blacks as not just that blacks are human beings, but whites are even greater human beings. No, blacks are not human beings, but they see them basically on the level of animals, right? So that, as we'll see in the next couple of passages, where Yehuda Halevi is going to expound upon that, that chas v'shalom, that is extremely far. That is, a polar opposite from the point of view of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and indeed from Torah as a whole. Torah says chaviv adam shnivra b'tzelem, that every human being is created in the image of the Ribbono Shel Olam. All of those mefarshim who talk about the Jews being different and distinct mean that above and beyond the regular position of a human being, which is an exalted human position, the Jews have something separate and extra, which is, makes them genetically more predisposed to be able to receive prophecy and a special connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, very good. So as we pointed out last time, some people are better at playing basketball than others. Right, so the Jews perhaps are predisposed to a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It doesn't mean in any which way that the rest of the nations of the world are somehow subhuman, Cholila, or that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is implying that in any which way. So that's where we left off. And the king of the Khazars, when introduced to this way of thought, is very taken aback. He says to the Rav, I started liking what you had to say, but all of a sudden, you're regressing. And the Rav says, give me a minute, I'll explain. And the king of the Khazar says, okay, you got your minute, I'm listening, but you better make it good. So that's where we left off last time. That's in Lamed Aleph. So, Omer HaChavir, B'din Ho'inin HaTivin Yishayv L'kichas HaMazon V'agidu V'holod V'cholchosam V'chol Tno'ayim V'siyachir Bozeh HaTzemach U'Balichayim Yibaladei Ho'adam V'avon V'hamotzoyim V'hayisodos. You'll agree to me, says the Rav to the Kuzari, that there's a substantial and a fundamental difference between the mineral world on the one hand and the vegetable and animal kingdom on the other hand. Right? The world of minerals and rocks, you know, doesn't grow, it doesn't have life, it doesn't require sustenance, it doesn't require food or water or anything like that, tender love and care, right? As opposed to animals and plants, which are organic, which live and need certain things in order to thrive. Water, food, you know, there's some kind of system of reproduction, both in the vegetable world and the plant world, as well as in the animal world, right? You'll acknowledge that there's a fundamental difference between these two layers, will you not? Amar HaKuzari, Zeklal Shitzarach Lefrotosav Al Emesi. Yeah, we'd have to expand upon that, but basically that's true. Amar HaChofer, Uv'inyin HaNavshi Yisyachadu Bali Chayim Kulom. Okay, let's take it one step further. You'll acknowledge that there is a fundamental difference between the vegetable, the plant world, and the animal world, right? In other words, after all, animals have movement, they have feelings, right? I mean, plants, you can talk to your plants. But I don't know if anyone would say that your plants really have feelings. You know, though, again, I never really tried. You know, sometimes...
So if you talk to them, they grow better.
Yeah, that's what they say, but I don't know. Just,
yeah, it's right.
You know.
I guess I don't talk to them.
They say that about kids also, but but I'm not sure. Yeah. But, you know, there's obviously a fundamental difference between plants and animals, right? You know, animals have character. Right, you can talk about a dog, a cat, you know, they have a certain character. You know, I mean, you know, you go over to your plants. I don't know that you would say they really, oh, this, he's a little shy. You know, he's, maybe you could say he's a wallflower, but I mean, that's about the extent of it. So, Amar HaKuzari Gam Zemavur Ein Derech L'Lchol. So, yeah, I agree to that, says the King of the Kesars. Amar HaKhovir V'din Ho'inin HaSich Lis Yachir HaMedaber Mikol HaChayim. And you'll agree to me as well that there's a fundamental difference between human beings and the rest of the animal kingdom. In other words, it's not just a question of a difference of degree, it's a difference of kind. Right? And those animals have tikkun hamidos. You can talk of, human beings have tikkun hamidos. You can talk of character refinement. You know, I mean, if you tell a monkey, you know, you have to work on your monkey kite, you know, learn Mesilas Yesharim and, you know, see if you could become a better monkey. Yeah, I don't know if that's going to work necessarily.
But there is something fundamental that will remain there. And the example that the Rambam brought of the cat and who was brought up to be a waiter.
Yeah.
The basic character of the cat remained.
There stays a cat.
A
cat is a cat, right. I mean, after all is said and done, right. I mean, that's...
Dogs are trained, seeing eye dogs.
Right, so, you know, again, animals could be trained to do things, but... You know, there's certain fundamental qualitative differences between animals and humans. As much as you can train animals to do certain things, you know, the concept of civilization is a human concept. The concept of creating government is a human concept. Yeah, animals organize themselves in packs, you know, but, you know, clearly there's a certain qualitative difference. What's that? Right. But he's even arguing, forget about Neshama for a minute. He's talking to the King of the Kesars, you know? So, you know, but just in terms of observable, you know, things that would be observable scientifically, right? There is a qualitative difference between animals and humans. Amar HaKuzari, Gamze Emes. Yeah, I agree to that. Okay, good. So now the Chavir, the Rav, has set up his argument. The world is divided into different strata of existence. You have the mineral world, you have the plant world, you have the animal world, you have the human world. Amar HaChavir. And what do you think is the stratum which is above human beings. What's the next rung up on the ladder? So I'm not Kusari. It's interesting. If you ask most people in the world today, they'd probably tell you that's it. Right? That's as far up as it goes. What do you mean? What do you mean? What's the next floor? What's the next level? That's where it stops. Right? The Kuzari doesn't say that. The king of the cases says, "Milas hachachamim hagedolim." I believe that true wise people are on an even higher level than just ordinary human beings. Right? Mineral, plant, animal, people, chachamim. So says the Chaver. I hear that. But any road salomar elomaila tafridis baaleha prida atzmis ki parit ha-semach min adomim ki parit ha-adom min ha-behema. I was talking about a difference in kind. Something that's a qualitative difference. You know, the difference between a plant and an animal is clearly a qualitative difference. But ha-prida b'me'avu ma'at ein lo tachlis. But when it comes to wisdom, you know, wisdom is not something which makes a qualitative difference. I mean, let's throw out the following thing, which the Kuzari doesn't say, but I think it brings home the point, right? So let's say, for argument's sake, that we considered very wise people to be a different stratum of existence above and beyond regular human beings, right? Let's say, Rahman al-Islam, that very wise person, developed some kind of mental disease and loses all of the wisdom that they had previously. Right? Would we say that that person now kind of regresses and falls back into the other category? You can't say that. Because, I mean, an animal can never become a plant. You know, a plant can never become a mineral. I mean, there's a brick wall, so to speak, that separates each level from the level on top of it. You know, here, the acquisition of wisdom which the person has is something which you could take away from the person in theory, right? I mean, till the person acquires it, what happens? You know, the person is, you know, just a regular baby, and they're a regular human being, and at a certain point they cross the line and they become a very wise person. You know, again, it doesn't work like that. A plant doesn't graduate to being an animal. An animal doesn't get left back and become a plant. It has to be a qualitative difference. So, Amar HaKuzari, Im kain ein maila b'murgashim yaseira mailas b'nei adam. Okay, so if you put it to me that way, says the king of the Kesars, I guess there is nothing higher than a human being. Amar HaChaver, says the Rav, v'im yimotzei adam shiova bo'esh v'lo yuzak bo. But let's imagine the following. Let's say I could point out to you a human being who could go through fire and not be injured. V'yamod mibli maicho v'lo yiraf. And he could go for long stretches without food and not get hungry. And the person would have a splendor, would give off a kind of light that, you know, you wouldn't be able to look at. And he would never get sick and he would never get weak. And when the person, when it comes time for the person to die, the person would just kind of climb into bed and say, God, I'm ready to go. And the same way that we go to sleep, the person would just kind of decide, okay, God, I'm ready to leave the world. And, you know, would be able to just depart in such a way. And the person would be able to know what happened in the past and to know the future. Wouldn't you say that that's a qualitatively different kind of person? A Superman. Right? Imagine we had a Superman. The comic book figure comes to mind a little bit. You know, there's nothing can hurt him. You can shoot a bullet at him. It's not going to hurt him. He can go through fire. He's not going to be hurt. He doesn't need to rest in conventional terms. He doesn't get sick. I mean, if you had this superhero, this Superman, wouldn't you say that that person is on a different level, a higher level than the average human being? That's a not just that the person happens to be higher, but that's a qualitatively different level of existence. Omar Akusari, I would, but Aval Amayla Hazos Elokis Malachusis, that's an angelic level of existence. The person you just described to me is an angel. Im hi nimtzeis, if such a thing exists. Omer HaChaver says back the Rav, it does exist. Eluk tzas ta'arei hanavi shelanu, asher ein olav cholek. What I just described to you is the Madrega, the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, the highest of all of the Nevi'im. Asher nira al yodo lehamon hischabrus hadavar ha'eloki bohem. All people saw that God connected himself in an unbelievable way to the person of Moshe Rabbeinu. V'shiyesh lohem elokam anhigam kirtsono v'loseis lo ish kidracha v'chfir ma'alola v'yavodosom v'hamrosom. And Moshe Rabbeinu communicated to the people that there is a God, that God is going to reward people, that God is going to punish people in accordance with their deeds. V'gid lohem anelom. Moshe Rabbeinu told them the future. V'hodiya eich hoya chidish ha'olam. Yachas b'nei odom kodom ha'mabu. He told them things which were in the distant past that only a Moshe Rabbeinu could have known. He told them how the world came into creation, into existence. He gave them the secrets of creation. And he described to them how people were before the Mabul, v'ehachaya ha'mabul, and how the flood was, etc. And, you know, all the stories in the beginning of Bereshis. And he told them everything, all about the history of man from the very beginning, things that only a Moshe Rabbeinu could have known. Now here, just we'll stop here and just talk about this Kuzari for a moment, because this hashkafa, this point of view that the Kuzari is putting forward, is probably one that we're not really familiar with from other sources. Basically, says the Kuzari, Moshe Rabbeinu was a superman. Someone, you know, we're used to thinking Moshe Rabbeinu as being an extraordinary human being, but I think most of us would say, you know, after all is said and done, he was a mortal human being. Says the Kuzari, no, that's not true. Moshe Rabbeinu was as distinct from other human beings the same way that plants and animals are two different kingdoms in the biological world. Right? Remember way back when in biology you had all this discussion about kingdoms and all of that. Don't ask me to go through all the different the gradations. But, you know, the different kingdoms. There's the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, the mineral kingdom, right? So, human beings are fundamentally distinct from animals. And the same way human beings are fundamentally distinct from animals, Moshe Rabbeinu is fundamentally distinct from human beings. And all of the things that we read about Moshe Rabbeinu in the Chumash, basically says the Kuzari, the fact that he went for 40 days and nights in Har Sinai without eating and drinking, that wasn't just a one-time miracle. That was an expression of the fact that somehow, during his lifetime, he was transformed into an almost angelic kind of creature, something that exceeded the regular madrega, the regular level of an ordinary human being. Right? When the Chumash says at the very end of Dvarim, Lo chasa eino, velo nos lecho, Moshe Rabbeinu was 120 years old, and he was in great condition. Right, he was as fit at the age of 120 as a person who would have been much younger. His vision didn't dim at the age of 120. He didn't need glasses, didn't even need contacts or anything like that. Velo nos lecho, I mean, he was just as strong physically at the age of 120 as, you know, somebody at the age of 20 or 30 or something like that. So that's not just, wow, you know, isn't that interesting? That's an expression of Moshe Rabbeinu's uniqueness and how he was really just a different type of a human being. Right? There was almost like a biological difference between Moshe Rabbeinu and, you know, the rest of the human population. A very fascinating and unique hashkafa on, you know, the kind of role that Moshe Rabbeinu plays. Now, the Kuzari gets off of this topic a little bit, but, you know, we're going to see in a few paragraphs, this is going to lead us back to the Kuzari's theme that there is a biological difference or a spiritual biological difference between the Jewish people who are the descendants, whether physically or spiritually, of Moshe Rabbeinu. The same way Moshe Rabbeinu was in a different category, the rest of the Jewish people are also in a different category, more, you know, able to receive prophecy and, you know, the closeness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu than the members of other nations. And, you know, he's going to develop that theme starting with the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu, and that somehow that's going to illustrate the uniqueness of the Jewish people as a whole. For the time being, however, the Kuzari gets off on a little bit of a tangent. Gamza Tema. Im Yeshet Slachem Minyan Boru Mibriya Sa'olam. You know, you mentioned, the king of the Khazars says to the Rav, you mentioned that you have this calendar that goes back to the creation of the world itself, and you know, you have a sense of the chronology, the years, from creation through Adam, through Noach, you know, all the way through Avraham Avinu. You know, that's quite astounding. The fact that you can date, you know, everything back to creation is really quite something. Now, we kind of take this for granted, the fact that the Jewish calendar starts at creation, but most calendar systems throughout history really didn't. You know, most calendar, the concept of a starting time for calendars through most of the ancient world had to do with whenever this regime took power. Right? There's a concept, for instance, that the Gemara makes reference to called Minyan Hashtaros, that, you know, that documents throughout the period of the Mishnah and the Gemara were dated from when? They were dated from a major victory which the Syrian Greeks had over the Ptolemies, over their enemies down in Egypt. Right? And basically, from the time that they had that major victory, they counted that as year one. And all of the documents throughout the Roman period, throughout the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara and the like, basically were dated from when? From this Greek victory. What about what happened before that Greek victory? You know, BV, you know, before the victory? We don't care. It doesn't count. History starts when we won. That was the common prevailing, you know, point of view that was true throughout antiquity.
Before the common era.
Right. I mean, the truth is, even to this day, you know, the Christian calendar, when Christianity comes onto the scene, that's when the world begins, right, as far as we're concerned. And it's only later that, you know, I mean, scientists and archaeologists have to come up with B.C. or B.C. Right, but you have to first, you know, they come up with that because we need a way to date all of those things that happened beforehand. But basically, the world starts, as far as we're concerned, with the birth of our Savior, you know, from their perspective. The Jewish concept that we start the calendar at the beginning, from creation, was a novel concept. And the king of the Khazars is just a little bit, you know, he's quite impressed by it. He says, you know, it's very impressive that you Jews are able to trace back things to the beginning of time, to the beginning of creation. Yeah, says Achavir, yeah, it's pretty good. Bo anu monim, that's how we count. Ve'ein bein shnei Yehudi machlokis mehodu v'yad kush. From India to Ethiopia, every Jew counts the same way. Which again, we kind of take for granted. But it's really quite astounding, right? I mean, with all the fighting that we Jews have, Baruch Hashem, about, you know, no shortage of things, it's amazing that we all use the same calendar, right? And, you know, the fact that we're all on the same page with the calendar is a major, major achievement of Achdus throughout the Jewish world. You know, you think about it, you think of all the other things that we argue over, it's not a simple thing that we're actually, you know, all using, you know, you can send out a Jewish calendar and the Ashkenazim, the Sfardim, the Chassidim, the Misnagdim, you know, everybody has the same calendar. Wow, that's
same page.
Pretty, right, but I mean, it's, you know, the fact that we all count the same way is an amazing thing. Amar HaKusari, V'kama Atimonim Hayom, by the way, what's the current date? So Amar HaChover, Arba'as Alofim V'chamesh Meos. This is the Jewish year, 4,500. Right. Now again, so it's fascinating. So this is actually a historical piece of information. 4,500 corresponds to the year 740 of the Common Era. And again, you know, it's about 300 years before Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi himself is writing. But again, we mentioned in the first class, that's approximately when the conversion of the Khazars took place. Sometime 700s, the 800s perhaps, right? So the Kusari tells you these events are happening in the year 740 CE. Right? He answers the question directly. The exact counting is spelled out in our Chumash. Ad Noach, Shein Vo'ever, El Avram, Yitzchok, V'Yakov, Ad Moshe. Right? That we can trace you know, by going through the Chumash and figuring out the number of years of Adam, Shes, Enosh, all the way through Moshe, we can figure out, based on the Chumash itself, how many years after creation it was that Moshe Rabbeinu was born. Right? If you don't want to do the math, you can just get an Arskel Chumash, turn to, I think it's the end of like Parshas Noach or something like that, and they have this very nice table where they do the whole thing for you in graph form. Right? You can actually figure out how many years from creation everybody is. And here writes the Kuzari as follows. Ve'elu hayu lev ha'adam uskulaso. These people were the very heart and the elite of mankind. L'chol echad mehem hayu banim. Each of these great individuals that we mentioned, Adam, Shes, Enosh, Noach, Shem, Eber, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, each of these people had children, but not all the children were equally significant. Some of them had children who would go on to preserve this super gene, this gene for spirituality. V'hasha'ar kiklipos, the other children that they had were like peels. They were like the rind. Right? In other words, you know, we shouldn't take it quite as derogatively as one would think, but in other words, you know, let's say Adam had three children, right? Cain, Hevel, and Shes. Cain and Hevel apparently did not receive this great spiritual gene from Adam HaRishon. Shes did. Shes passed it on to Enosh, right, his son. Shes had other children. The Pasuk says, if you go through the genealogy, in Perek Hay of Sefer Bereishis, after every person who's mentioned, it says, Vayoled banim uvanos, he gave birth to, you know, to sons and daughters. But for some reason, the sons and daughters aren't mentioned. Only one child, you know, in each case is mentioned as the successor to his father. Says Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the reason for that is because not everybody got this spirituality gene. Adam had it, his son Shes had it, his son Enosh had it, but none of Enosh's siblings had the gene, so therefore they basically fade off of the earth, you know, they fade off of the face of history, because we're interested in tracing this gene for spirituality as it runs through mankind. Einam domim la'avos, these other children were not like their incredible parents. V'lo yischaber bohen ha'inyan ha'eloki. This divine element did not attach itself to them. V'nimno ha'minyan la'elo ha'elokiyim. That's why the Torah only counts these godly people. V'hayu yichidim v'lo rabim. In each case, these were just individuals. The masses of people were nothing special, nothing to write home about. They didn't have this particular gene. It was these yichidei skula, these individuals who had this particular power, you know, this particular gene, which was passed down from generation to generation. Ad sheholid Yaakov Avinu shneim asar shvatim, until Yaakov Avinu gave birth to the 12 tribes, kulam reuyin l'inyan ha'eloki. Yaakov Avinu's children were the first time in history that everybody got the gene. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, etc. Everybody who was a child of Yaakov Avinu got this gene. Kulam reuyin l'inyan ha'eloki. They're all fit to receive this divine element. V'shava ha'elokus b'kahal rav. And for the first time, divinity and spirituality was able to spread over a nation, not just individuals. And they were the ones who counted. We count all of the Shvatim, all of the descendants, all of the children of Yaakov Avinu, and they created the Jewish people, and the Jewish people, by definition, every Jewish person has this gene for spirituality. V'anachnu kibalnu minyan shnei akadmonu mimoshe. Coming back to the issue of the calendar, right? We digressed for a minute to talk about this unique gene that was passed on from generation to generation. But by the way, you know, coming back to the calendar, the Chumash chronicles all of the years up until Moshe Rabbeinu. We can figure that out just from using the Chumash, right? Because we know from Adam to Noah, we know from Noah to Avram, we can count from Avram to Yitzchak, to Yitzchak to Yaakov, from Yaakov we can count all the way to Moshe Rabbeinu. And basically, we have a tradition, says the Rav to the Kuzari, as to the number of years that have elapsed from Moshe Rabbeinu to our own day. Right? So here again, we see this concept, which the Kuzari is going to come back to, the unique character which the Jewish people has, which started with Adam HaRishon, and we're basically taking that gene, tracing it through the generations, and you know, it comes to its full fruition in the Jewish people as a whole. Omar HaKuzari, Zeh HaPrat, Marchik HaMachshav HaHara Min HaLev MiHaKosav HaHaskama, Ki Dover Kazeh Yevshei SheYaskimo Elav HaSar Mibli SheYisbalu VeYigalu Sod HaSkamosam, the fact that everybody among the Jews agrees on your calendar, it in its own right is its own proof of its veracity. Because if you tried to convince the masses of something which was a lie on this magnitude, you know, this is the number of years that have gone by since creation, etc. It's such a big lie that you would never succeed in pulling it off. The Haminyan Karov, and the truth is 4,500 years. It's not so long ago. You know, it's been 4,500 years since creation. Ein HaKozo VeHaShekher Yochel Ikones Olof. It's impossible to fathom that something like that could be fabricated. Again, if you go back, this is the same, again, the Kuzari's theme, which he comes back to again and again. You know, the fact when the masses agree on something, it must be true. As if all Jews are on the same page with the chronology since creation, and the other nations of the world don't even make claims as to when the world was created. Again, you know, this is obviously not true nowadays in 2009, where scientists, you know, have various claims about when the world was created. But, you know, in antiquity and throughout the Middle Ages, the other nations didn't really have an opinion as to when the world came into existence. It came into existence a long time ago, before us. All right, sure. So the Jews are really the only people that have this tradition as to when exactly, you know, the world came into being, and they can trace it, you know, generation after generation, all the way from Adam HaRishon, something which is agreed upon by so many people without dispute must be true by definition. It can't be. You couldn't get so many people to rally around something which would be a lie. Amar HaKhalid. And the Rav continues. Yeah, you're right. Aval Avram Avinu, haya asma b'dor haflaga. You should know that Avram Avinu himself lived through the events of the Migdal Bavel, of the building of the Tower of Babel, and the generation of the dispersion. V'nisharhu krovav b'loshon eiver avi aviv. He and his people saw. He and his family saw the dispersion and the breaking up of humankind into different languages, and Avram Avinu clung to the language of his grandfather Eiver. He clung to Hebrew, v'lozeh nikro Ivri, and that's why Avram Avinu is called Ivri, the Hebrew, because the fact that he chose to maintain Hebrew even when the other languages were being developed. Right, so here's a worthwhile, just an important piece of information that the Kuzari throws out over here. If anyone has ever asks you, why is he called Avram HaIvri? Right, so we know Chazal.
He's from Eiver.
Right.
No,
so
he's Eiver Acher. Kol Olam v'Echad v'Avram. But this is different.
Right. So there are a bunch of different explanations for this. Right. The Pashat of Pshat. Is that he's Avraham from the other side, Aver meaning the other side of the river. He came from Haran, he came from Ur Kasdim, and he passed over the Jordan River to come to Eretz Yisrael. He's May Aver HaNahar from the other side of the river, so he's Avram HaIvri, Avram from the other side. Right? That's one explanation. That's probably the simplest pshat. Or Chazal say, as the Rebbetzin Berkowitz mentions, that kol ha'olam mitzad echad v'hum ha'ever ha'acher. Avraham Avinu was a revolutionary. The whole world held like this, and he rejected the whole world. He rejected the idolatry of the whole world, and he held the monotheism. But here the Kuzari is saying a third pshat, a different pshat. Avraham ha'ivri means he spoke the language of Eiver. He spoke Hebrew.
Aver was a descendant of
somebody.
Aver was a descendant.
Aver was his grandfather, right? And he's one of the generations from Noach to Avraham Avinu. The Beis Medrash of Shem ve'Aver, right? So that's Aver, you know, who's the grandfather of Avraham Avinu. And the language of Aver was Hebrew. The language of everybody was Hebrew prior to the Migdal Bavel, prior to the Tower of Babel. And Avraham Avinu clung to Hebrew, even though all these other languages were being introduced and put into put into existence. Avraham Avinu clung to Hebrew, the language of Aver, and that's why we call him Avraham Ivri, right? Now it's very interesting. So according to the Kuzari, the whole title of Avraham Avinu has to do with his language. Apparently, language is a very defining element, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and indeed we'll see throughout the Kuzari. The Kuzari holds that the Hebrew language is the most beautiful language in the world, and that all the other languages are just spin-offs of Hebrew. And understanding Hebrew well will help you understand things about God Himself. Right? So, language is not just an incidental thing, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Language is fundamental. And the very term Avraham Ivri means Avraham who spoke the language of Aver. He spoke this beautiful Lashon Kodesh, which defined who he was. Uva Moshe Acharav La'arba Meos Shana. Moshe Rabbeinu came after Avraham Avinu just a mere 400 years later. By the way, if you ever want to remember, it's a good trick. The Yetzias Mitzrayim takes place exactly 500 years after the birth of Avraham Avinu, according to our traditional chronology. Avraham Avinu was born in the year 1948 on the Jewish calendar, right? And right, that works out pretty interestingly also. Right, but after the birth of Yitzchak we know was born when Avraham Avinu was 100. So if you just do the elaborate calculus which is involved over here, so Avraham Avinu, 500 years exactly after the birth of Avraham Avinu, 1948 plus 500, right? In other words, 2448 is the year of the Exodus of Yetzias Mitzrayim on the Jewish calendar, right? So that's just, you know, if you want to keep the dates straight, you know, there's exactly, according to our tradition, exactly 500 years between the birth of Avraham Avinu and Yetzias Mitzrayim. The world was filled up at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu with the wisdom of heaven and earth. Right, when Moshe came to Paro, the sages of Klal Yisrael were skeptical about whether this man was really for real, whether God really spoke to him. The truth is, the Jews didn't fully believe Moshe Rabbeinu until the Aseres HaDibros were revealed at Har Sinai. The truth is, the skepticism of the Jews is a sign of their intelligence. It wasn't a sign of their foolishness. The Jews knew that it was easy to pull the wool over people's eyes. You know, they believed in astrology, and they knew that people were capable of using astrology and magic to create all kinds of things. So they were skeptical initially of Moshe Rabbeinu, and it took something of the magnitude of Matan Torah to convince the people that, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu was really on the ball, that he was really for real. So if Moshe Rabbeinu could convince those skeptical Jews, it must be that there was something there. Me'asher lo yamdu lemechkar. Ve'eich yale b'dashi yiduma etzlam, ki halashonos asher hayu lifnim kachamesh mi'al shona, hayu lashen eivr levado, v'nifleko b'bovel b'mei peleg, v'yachas uma kach v'kach l'yefes. Says the Kuzari again, Moshe Rabbeinu came to the Jewish people and he told them, you know, 500 years ago, less than 500 years ago, everybody in the world spoke a common language. Right? I mean, just do the cheshbon, right? From the birth of Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu is 48 at the time of the Migdal Bavel. So from, you know, it's less than 500 years from Migdal Bavel till Yetzias Mitzrayim, Moshe Rabbeinu has to convince the Jewish people that, by the way, less than 500 years ago, everybody spoke a single language. Now, if that isn't true, you know, says the Kuzari, how on earth would he ever have been able to convince them that that was the case? I mean, if he came to us today and said, by the way, 500 years ago, everybody spoke a single language, I said, what are you talking about? You know, I know you're wrong. Right? I had to read Beowulf, you know, way back when in English class, right? And I don't understand what he's talking about, but, you know, but I know it's a, you know, it's not quite the English that we use today, and I know there are other languages out there, you know. So 500 years is not such a long period of time. If Moshe Rabbeinu was going to try to convince the Jews, he was going to try to lie to the Jews and tell them that a mere 500 years ago everybody spoke the same language, if it wasn't true, they never would have bought, you know, such a bag of goods. Amar HaKuzri in paragraph Nun, Ze lo yitochein. Yeah, clearly that couldn't be. Ve'ech yitochein ze, v'anachnu motzim ha'chochmus b'ksav yad mechabreya mechamish me'az shana. We have, right now, you know, books of wisdom that are 500 years old. Udvar mishahaya chamish me'az shana li'avor ha'kosav al-gilosa k'mo yachasim ha'lishonus v'aksivos. You could never falsify things to that extent to say that a mere 500 years ago, you know, there was only one language or the like. Right? So the Rav goes on to say, certainly no one would have argued on Moshe, certainly, had it not been totally true and recognizable, they would have argued on Moshe Rabbeinu. Says the Kuzari, you're right. Okay, I'm going to skip through a little bit. I'm going to skip through to Nun Zayin. Right? Again, in bringing out things that just show the universal nature of Torah, Omer Achove, and Nun Zayin, it's paragraph 57. Hashomato al Uma, Shecholekes b'Shavua Hayodua, Shehaschaloso miyomrishon v'ashlamoso b'Shabos. Have you ever heard of a nation that didn't hold of a 7-day week? Right. Now, the truth is, apparently there are. But at the time of the Kuzari, it was universally accepted that, you know, the week is 7 days. Which, if you think about it, is a very non-intuitive sort of thing. Right? Because the number seven doesn't really correspond to anything in nature. A month is 30 days, because that's the cycle of the moon. Right? A year is 12 months, because that's the cycle of the sun. Okay, those are all natural things. A day is 24 hours, because that's the cycle, you know, again, of the rotation of the earth. Okay. If not for the Maisa Bereishis, if not for the notion that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, where would you get the notion of seven from in creating the days of the week? Right? So that argument, says the Rav to the Kuzari, have you ever heard of anybody who has a week that's other than 7 days? Hayitochin shyishvu b'zeh anshei tzin. Is it possible that everybody from China all the way to the Western Islands agrees on this? Unless there was some kind of universal acceptance of this? I mean, it wouldn't be that, you know, all these groups would come to the 7-day week on their own. There must have been some universal starting point where everybody was together. Yeah. It would have to be that everybody agreed to this together. V'zeh rachok. O shiyu amedabrim kulam b'nei adam b'nei achon zolosom. Or that we all stem from a common ancestor and we all have this common tradition of a 7-day week. Otherwise, how would you explain the fact that so many different nations have this concept of a 7-day week? Okay. I'm going to skip through a little bit. And I'm going to go to Samech Beis. And just skipping through a little bit again, he speaks a lot about these sort of things: the 7-day week, the fact that we count by in units of 10 is universally agreed upon throughout the world. Amar Akuzari in Samech Beis, Emar ki to'anti olecha ba'uma hamufkeres uva'am sheinu maskim odas achas ve'itavto atshuva bozer. I have a question against you, says the Kuzari to the Rav. We know that Greek philosophy preaches that the world is eternal. We spoke about this in the very beginning of the Sefer, where the philosopher comes and presents his point of view to the king of the Khazars, and he says, "You should know, I believe that the world never had a beginning, is never going to end, and that, you know, the world is eternal." So how do you, you know, the philosophers are not stupid people. They're people who are, you know, tremendously sophisticated, and they have ways of research and things of that nature. How do you account for the fact that the philosophers don't buy in to the Jewish understanding that the world was created, and that the, you know, the Jews can actually pinpoint the actual dates when the creation took place and all of the various dates which happened after that? I mean, if you're so right, how come the philosophers don't agree with you? So Amar Achavir, Samech Gimel, Hapilosofim, Eim Lahashim Osam. The philosophers are wrong, but we can't really blame them for being wrong. It's not their fault. They never got Torah or wisdom as an inheritance. They're Greeks. The Yavon, again, if you look in Chumash, the Greeks are descended from Yefes, you know, the third of Noach's sons, and they live up there in the north in Europe. True wisdom was only passed on from Noach through his son Shem. So that's the revealed tradition of wisdom, which was passed down from Shem, ultimately into the Jewish people. The Greeks don't have this tradition of revealed wisdom. Whatever they had to figure out, they had to figure out on their own. So they did pretty well for people who didn't actually have access to the notes from the lecture. But, you know, how can you blame them if they didn't get everything 100% right? Lo poska ha-chochma v'lo tifsok min ha-skula ahime odom. You know, the descendants of Shem never lost that wisdom, that divine wisdom which was passed down from Adam through Noah. The truth is, the Greeks only acquired wisdom from the time that they became strong and conquered the Persians. And then they were able to take over some of the wisdom which had been developed in Persia and appropriate it as their own. And the Persians in turn got it from the Babylonians. And the great Greek philosophers only really appeared on the scene after they had conquered the Persians. Lo kodem lo chen v'lo la'achar mikein. Not really before then, and not really after them either. U'me'esh she'shova hamalchus l'romiyim. And when the Romans conquered the Greeks, lo kom bohem pilosof meforsom ad ata. There haven't been any really famous Greek philosophers since the Romans conquered the Greeks. Up until the present day, the Greek philosophical enterprise was a blip on the screen of history. It came for a short period of time. They took it all from the Persians, who in turn took it from the Babylonians. And, you know, don't get so excited over Greek philosophy. It was an aberration in history.
You don't hear about Roman philosophers.
Right. So, Omar Akuzeri, you're telling me that we shouldn't take Aristotle and his wisdom seriously because it's like a blip on the screen of history? Omar Achover King, yeah, that's exactly what I mean. We shouldn't take Aristotle so seriously. Mipnei she'tviach esichlo machshavto. Aristotle was a brilliant man, but he had to work hard to come up with his philosophy because he didn't really have any tradition that would have shown him the right way to go. Aristotle wasn't sure, was the world eternal or did the world have a beginning? He really couldn't figure it out. So when he thought about it, his abstract thought led him to the conclusion that the world is eternal. Right? But you know, had he Had this philosopher, Aristotle, been part of the Jewish nation, where he would have received the tradition with his mother's milk, he would have gotten all of this information that we have in Bereishis, and it would have been a tradition passed down to him that the world is created. He would have put his efforts, his philosophical mind, into supporting the concept that the world was created. Rather than putting all of his effort into proving the eternity of the world, which doesn't really make all that much sense, he would have been better off spending his time reinforcing the Kabbalah's, you know, the traditions that he would have received through Torah, i.e. the fact that the world has a beginning and has an end. This is an incredibly bold statement that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi makes. I mean, you have to remember, again, as we spoke about at the very beginning of the Sefer, the world at large, and the Jews as well, were in love with Greek philosophy throughout the Middle Ages. Again, it was the philosophy of Aristotle, as interpreted by the Muslim philosophers of the Middle Ages, and the world went gaga over it, and, you know, a few years later, the Rambam was going to write his Mor Nevuchim to try to explain Yiddishkeit to people who were enamored of Greek philosophy. And comes along Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and says, I'm not so impressed by Aristotle. He wasn't so great. The Greek philosophers weren't so incredible. They just got their philosophy from the Persians. And Aristotle himself, yeah, he was a very bright man, but, if he would have learned in Cheder, he would have gone even further than, you know, what he actually became, you know, just studying Greek philosophy on his own. If he would have had a tradition, he could have gone even further, you know, in developing intellectually than what he ultimately became. Now, this is an incredibly bold statement. It's a very chuspidic statement, in a certain sense, vis-a-vis Greek philosophy. But it was typical of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, as we pointed out earlier. He was the anti-philosopher. His whole point was that philosophy is not going to get you anywhere. The only religion which makes sense is the religion which you can experience. And frankly, you know, I'm not even so impressed with, you know, the wisdom of philosophy. We're going to see later on, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to say, whatever is correct in philosophy trickled into the Greek thinking from the Jews. They got it from us. Whatever you find in there which is silly is silly. And whatever you find there which is worthwhile somehow made its way, you know, from Torah back into the Greek point of view. So, you know, it's really nothing there which is even worth talking about, even worth, you know, spending your time trying to reconcile. It's an incredibly bold statement. And in his own age, you know, again, as we see from the Rambam just a little bit later, not everybody bought it. I mean, the Rambam obviously took Aristotle very, very seriously and felt that he had to write the Mor Nevuchim to deal with some of the issues that he brought up. But nonetheless, I think Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is providing this tremendous antidote to the love affair that so many Jews had with Greek philosophy at that time by saying, it's stupid, it's not worth anything. It was a jolt, it was a wake-up call to get people to say, you know, okay, maybe there's something there, but maybe we shouldn't, you know, accept everything that Greek philosophy has to tell us dogmatically. You know, maybe there is room to say that we should analyze Torah on its own merits without feeling that we have to explain it, you know, and answer it up in light of Greek philosophy. Bez Hashem will pick up next time, hopefully with books, and, you know, we'll continue seeing these themes which Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi stresses again and again, the superiority of the Jews, the superiority of Torah, the real inferiority of Greek philosophy, that it's nothing to write home about at all, and the special school of for prophecy and closeness to God, which has gone through the Jewish people throughout the ages. You know, again, these themes which we've seen, you know, once and twice are starting to come up again and again and give us a complete picture of, you know, the hashkafa that he has, you know, looking at Torah and looking at the world.